I'm Adam Coleman, inviting you to the fifth season of The Cosmic Library from LitHub. This season, we go on our tiniest reading adventure yet, into short stories in the U.S. But this too turns out to be almost all-encompassing.
I think short stories are essentially brief encounters with felt life.
That's Oxford literary scholar Andrew Kahn, who gives us a deep history of the short story. And we hear from The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman, who explains her work as an editor of short fiction.
You know, if you are melding with another person, you don't turn that person into you, but you get to know the ins and outs of that person. So, and it's sort of like that. I always feel involved with the stories.
We bounce around between the history and current life of short stories with the novelist Justin Taylor.
The nice thing about it going out of fashion is that it really frees you up to relate to it in a different way.
This being the Cosmic Library, we make sure to go way beyond U.S. short stories, too. Here's the Washington Post critic, Becca Rothfeld.
A lot of Kafka short stories, I think, gesture at or describe sort of nightmarish geographies or architectures.
And the actor Max Gordon Moore reminds us just how wild short stories can be. With a reading in its entirety of Wakefield, the intensely strange, classic Nathaniel Hawthorne story.
He had contrived, or rather he had happened to dissever himself from the world, to vanish.
Get ready for all that and more in a season about short stories, small windows into vast universes. It's season 5 of The Cosmic Library, available soon wherever you go for podcasts.
Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Donner. Her essays, reportage, and reviews have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times Book Forum, Guernica, and The Believer. All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days is her third and latest book. She's also the author of a novel, Sunset Terrace, and Burnout, a graphic novel about eco-terrorism. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you, Maris. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. Rebecca, I feel like in All the Frequent Troubles of Our Days, you don't talk about your childhood necessarily, but you let us imagine what it was like, that you had this aunt who your grandmother kind of idolized, it seemed.
Yeah.
And you grew up with the lore about her. Is that fair to say?
I would say so, except it wasn't... It didn't really surround me. It was more of a kind of spectral presence. Mm-hmm. I was aware that I had, she's my great-great aunt. It was my grandmother's aunt, and that she was a prominent figure in people's imaginations and memories, but nobody wanted to talk about her. And so my first memory was when I was 9 and my great-grandmother wanted to measure my height, as all the children's heights were measured against her kitchen wall. And after she put a ruler on my head and made the mark on the wall, I stood back and then I saw a very faint mark with an M next to it. And I asked her, who's that? And she said, Mildred. So that was the first time I heard her name, but she didn't want to tell me anything more. I just knew that she was my great, great aunt. And for me, the mystery of Mildred began right then. And then when I was 16, my grandmother told me more. And it was then that I learned that she had been in the resistance and that she had been beheaded by guillotine on Hitler's direct order. And this was the time when my grandmother gave me Mildred's letters that she wrote to the family when she was in Germany. And her family was sort of scattered across the Midwest, but primarily in Wisconsin and in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And basically my grandmother urged me to tell her story. And so at that point I knew that I wanted to be a writer, and I promised her that I would.
But it's a completely different undertaking than your two other books. To write fiction and then get into the form of biography seems like a big switch.
Yes, it certainly was. I've always been a voracious reader, and I was particularly drawn to this period because I knew that I had a relative who played a role in the history of the German resistance. Uh, and and that it was quite unusual because she was the only American in the leadership of the German resistance, according to historians, but historians have gotten her wrong on so many other facts. And there are so many rumors and misapprehensions that swirl around the story of Mildred. And so when I decided that I really wanted to begin writing this book in earnest, I made the artistic choice to write a work of narrative nonfiction rather than historical fiction. Mm-hmm. I wanted to approach this biography, however, in an unconventional way. And so I felt that the power of the story is that it's true. Yeah. And so why fictionalize it? But I should mention that a number of editors, when we were shopping the book around, said, "Rebecca," because I had written two works of fiction, unsurprisingly, they said, "Well, why don't you just make this historical fiction?" And I said, "Absolutely not. I believe that that it's a true story and it needs to be treated as such." And one editor actually told me to swim in my own lane.
Whoa. Hey there.
You should swim in your own lane. And that kind of fired me up and made me all the more dedicated to this idea that this would be a rigorously researched work of narrative nonfiction and that I would visit our archives in numerous countries. And so that's what I did. I mean, not only did I research the National Archives and the Library of Congress, and I also visited institutional archives across the United States, but also I went to Berlin, I went to London, and I worked with a historian based in Moscow to access espionage files. Basically, espionage files are almost all under lock and key, but there are some exceptions, and I was able to then incorporate that research in my narrative about Mildred Harnack and her involvement with the German resistance, which included working as a spy. So that's why I felt that it was important to tell that story as fully as possible. As I started writing the book, then it started to take shape in my mind as a kind of fusion of biography, espionage thriller, and scholarly detective story.
Yes. And tell me a little bit about, I love your devotion to telling this true story. Tell me about the parts that you felt comfortable imagining a little bit. And I like narratively, there's you would say in the book, like, picture Mildred doing, right. Yeah. You know, like, because, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I felt it very. I wanted to give her a kind of Mrs. Dalloway moment early on in the book and show her beginning her day, and I wanted the reader to experience a morning with her, and I had letters again that my grandmother had given me that helped me with details such as, what does her apartment look like? What did her rugs look like? What were the colors on them? I also knew that from a Plutense prison questionnaire that she filled out right before her execution, and she had to list all of her possessions. And so I was able to, and she lists some of her furnishings. And so I was able to, in my mind, furnish the place and put her in it. I knew that there are details in that scene in particular where I talk about the sock that one heel is wearing thin. I know that because of a letter. And I know that her mother sent her another sock to replace it. I knew her routine and I knew what the windows looked like. And I knew that also because of my interviews with her 11-year-old courier, and I interviewed him when he was 89, and he was really probably the last person who was alive who had direct knowledge of her espionage and indeed participated in it. And I can tell you more, we can talk more about that.
Yeah.
But so I had all these different sort of ways of looking in on her on this morning. But I also followed a very strict set of rules for myself. I never imagined what she was thinking. I would, if I say she thought this, I know that because there's a letter that said that she thought that, or I know that because somebody who knew her wrote about it in a memoir and said Mildred felt this way or thought that. There were few survivors in her group. Almost everyone was executed, but there were a couple exceptions. Unfortunately, they wrote memoirs and gave post-war testimonies. And so that first chapter, Good Morning Sunshine, is what it, that's, and then I also thought, I mean, fortunately, when this is in the early stages of writing, I thought, well, it can be any day, it could be any morning, where I show her waking up, but I actually need to, it has to be a significant day in some way. And in fact, I was able to find that and identify a particular day when she started working at this night school for adults. And she was so excited, and she wrote about this to her mother. And this was after she had gotten fired from the University of Berlin for her, for being outspoken about her antipathy toward the Nazi Party and toward Hitler in particular. And so after she was fired, she quickly got a position at this night school for adults. And so that's the morning that I was able to write about. And, but yes, so I say, picture her at the end of that chapter. Yeah. I ask the reader, picture her walking down the stairs, picture her swinging her satchel. Anybody looking at her would assume that she was just an American graduate student, nothing more. And so I do those, I did make use of those kinds of, formulations, and that was my way of just sort of just getting right up to the border between nonfiction and fiction, but not quite crossing it. But every time she says something, anything that appears in quotes, anytime that is drawn directly from a letter, a post-war testimony, a memoir, and as I said again, same goes for if I say she felt, she thought.
Right.
And so I was able to hold myself to those very strict rules, and then also just get very close to that border. And it was a risk. It was an artistic risk. I thought, I'm doing all of this extensive research and bringing news to this story, and sharing facts and uncovering facts that no one has done so. No one yet has written about some of the things that I write about in this book. And so conventional historians will be interested in what I have uncovered, but conventional historians will not necessarily be happy with my narrative strategy. That's what I thought. And in fact, I've gotten so many letters from people saying, my God, this is, I love what you do. So it was a risk worth taking.
That's great. Discover your holiday love story with Audible. Listen to exclusive stories, original podcasts, and more. Enjoy brand new Audible originals like Hold Me Closer, Tony Danzig, There's Something About Mary, and Christmas Podcast. Woof. Keep the fire going with romance favorites like Eight Winter Nights and Nick and Noel's Christmas Playlist. Tis the season to get cozy. Go to audible.com/holidayromance. Listen now, only from Audible.
Let's go back to Mildred, because even as a Midwestern girl in the 20s and 30s, she was different.
Yes, she was. She was different.
Tell me about her life in academia and her reading and her beliefs.
Sure. Yeah. So she was born in 1902. She was the daughter of a suffragette. Her mother was believed very strongly in women's rights. Her mother had a 10th grade education, and basically was at some point had to teach herself typing because her husband, Mildred's father, was this ne'er-do-well alcoholic horse trader, and he would hold a job as a butcher or an insurance salesman, but never for very long, and so then he would lose the job and then try to return to horse trading, and then he would buy his horses and then sell them when he needed the money, and they moved year after year. I have this long list of her addresses that I tracked down, and when I went to the Milwaukee city directories, and often it was just right down the street, but it was just a series of boarding houses that they lived in, and they moved every time they couldn't pay the rent. So she had this impoverished childhood. Her mother even wrote to a member of the family when Mildred was a teenager, I'm afraid of, that I'm not able to feed Mildred enough. I mean, they were really that poor that that food was also hard to come by. And so at the same time, well, Mildred was the youngest in the family and known as the little Pip. So she was this very vivacious girl, and she would roam the streets of Milwaukee on her own, and she did spend a lot of time alone. And I think this is when she became a reader, and she also and eventually became a scholar. But she devoured books, and she had this ambition to go to college, which was extraordinary for me to consider, you know, at that mm-hmm. time. And so, fortunately, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin offered free tuition to state residents
yeah.
and also allowed men and women both to attend. And so she had this opportunity. And so she enrolled it in university and then got her bachelor's degree and then went on to get her master's degree. And she was very, she really, I think, was radicalized at the University of, yeah. of Wisconsin. She joined a group called the Friday Nighters, and basically it was this feisty group of students who of self-proclaimed communists and socialists and anarchists and suffragettes. And there was a professor there who was sort of presided over these meetings, who was very inspiring to her. And so she would go off to rallies and she met a German student there, to a graduate student. His name was Arvid Harnack. And he would go with her to various political rallies, and they fell swiftly in love. And so they married a week after she received her master's degree. And then shortly thereafter, as a kind of honeymoon, they hitchhiked to a small coal mining town in Colorado and joined the strikers and joined the picket line to protest poor working conditions and poor pay. So their love was really, they had these, and he also had this great belief and support for women's rights. So their love was very much, or that link between them was political as well as emotional. And they had a very big romance, and I think that sustained them through those years in the 1930s as it got increasingly dangerous to be, you know, at the center of this resistance group. And then when the Second World War started, it was even more treacherous. And it was around that time Arvid bought her a ticket to go back home and said,
right,
you've got to go. You're not, we probably won't survive. And she refused. She said she basically couldn't leave him, couldn't leave the group. Knew she was risking her life every day. But as an American, she was, unlike many people in Germany, she could have gone back, and she didn't.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the things you illustrate so beautifully that I'm going to take away from reading this book is the change in her personality. From this vivacious young girl to a woman who potentially is knows that she is in danger. And you describe the paranoia of Berlin in the 1930s so vividly. Yeah. And I'm never quite sure when we talk about paranoia, if you are actually in danger, terrible danger, how is that paranoia?
Right, that's true. realistic about the situation.
Yeah, and you even get into, you know, Hitler was paranoid, and so was Stalin. And yes. Your neighbors could turn on you at any moment.
Yep.
Tell me about, Mildred did go back to the Midwest in 1937.
Yeah.
And the reaction to her at the time was that she had changed.
Yes. Yes, she was no longer a great little Pip in anyone's eyes. She was no longer this vivacious, girl. Of course, she was a grown woman. But the last time they had seen her was when she was in her mid-20s. And now in 1929, it was when she got on a steamer ship and crossed the Atlantic and to the North Sea and ended up in basically starting her life anew and as a PhD student in Germany. Her mother was dying, and so it appears that she realized this was probably the last chance that she could go back and see her mother. So in 1937, she went back. She stayed for a couple weeks with one of her former, with a classmate at the University of Berlin who was really bitchy and wrote these letters, basically just criticizing her and saying, you know, she makes a fetish of her morning exercises and she's talking all the time about her scholarly ambitions and, but that she was also weird. And this is her friend, Clara. She just thought she was really weird and yes, paranoid and brittle. And other classmates, she threw a big party for Mildred and other classmates came. And this was the prevalent impression among many people who then later talked about it and wrote about it, that Mildred Harnack was so odd and closed off. And when somebody came up to her at the party and said, can you tell me about, you know, I heard that you went to the Soviet Union. Can you tell me about that? And Mildred said, we don't talk about that. Very icily. And so, I mean, unsurprisingly, her friends just were really believed that she had changed. And indeed she had. She had been living in a fascist dictatorship since Hitler became chancellor in 1933. And Germany swiftly progressed from a parliamentary democracy where the Germans enjoyed freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom to protest in the streets. And all of that was swiftly snatched away from them after Hitler became chancellor and turned Germany into a fascist dictatorship. So
yeah, tell me a little bit about presenting this history that we all know on some level in terms of Hitler's rise.
Yeah.
And his various crimes. What were you trying to focus on narratively in telling us this history?
Well, I think this was another moment in the writing of this book where I thought I'm going to make an unconventional artistic choice. And I decided to write this book in the present tense. Mm-hmm. Even though this is a history, it's a part biography. And usually when we read histories and biographies, they're written in the past tense. She said this, she did this. But I felt that there was there's a distance that's established between, that's imposed on the book and the distances the reader from the material. And I had this image of these black and white, you know, those newsreels that are sort of stuttering and the sepia toned and they seem so irrelevant to modern day issues and dynamics and yet a lot of times those newsreels depict dynamics that are very much present in our current society and so I wanted to effectively show this in color and show it as it was happening right now. So when I discussed the rise of fascism and you get to see this through Mildred's eyes, because again, she's writing about this and she's writing to her mother and saying, and because her mother has a 10th grade education, she's also explaining this in very sort of simple terms. So she breaks down the political situation in ways that actually made it a lot easier for me to utilize her letters in a narrative way. And she talks about tells her mother about the Nazi party and what's going on and how people are lining up to listen to Hitler. But I wanted to, just going back to the point about the present tense. So I show early on in the book, Mildred in Germany shortly after she arrived in 1929 and show her going to the University of Berlin the last day when she's fired. And this is in 1932. Hitler still has not become chancellor. In fact, he ran for president and lost, but he's still giving speeches and he's tremendously popular. And, you know, Mildred, as this American graduate student, bore witness to it all. In the year before she arrived in 1928, the Nazi party got less than 3% of the vote in the Reichstag election, the Reichstag being the Germany's parliament. In 1930, 2 years later, the Nazi party got 18%. And in 1932, 2 years later, the Nazi party got 37% of the vote in the Reichstag election. And for the first time, it was the largest party in the Reichstag. And there was a dizzying array of other political parties that represented everything from the far left to the far right. But you know, Mildred saw this as an urgent threat. And she wrote time and time again in her letters, oh, we have to do something about this. And also we have to do something about the poor. She witnessed just people starving all around her. And the gap between rich and poor was very pronounced. And she would see women in mink coats and jewels going to the opera. And then she would see beggars on the street right outside the opera and then people sort of just stepping over them. And so it was a time of great extremes. And then very shortly thereafter, when Hitler is appointed chancellor, January 30, 1933, Mildred experienced Germany then becoming a dictatorship. And that's when I felt in writing this book that I wanted to give readers a history lesson and show how that happened, because I think a lot of people have the impression, a mistaken impression, that there was some kind of bloody coup. Mm-hmm. And really it all happened legally. And everyone lost their constitutional rights in a peaceful way. It was basically mm-hmm. decided. There were a series of events, and I won't go into them now, but I explained them, how each event led to the next and that eventually resulted in Germany becoming a fascist dictatorship.
But yeah, and you talk about, I think most Americans know about the concept of appeasement and the idea that perhaps you could bargain with Hitler, or that he was not right. He wanted peace, they thought.
Sure. And he kept telling people he did.
And he kept telling people. Yeah. And yet at the same time, you make it very clear that Mildred and Arvid both have tried to warn various people, governments,
yes,
everyone around them, people for whom they've spied. No one
paid attention.
To believe.
No, unfortunately, no one believed the German resistance. I quote political figures who actually say we don't even believe it exists. You know, and mm-hmm. this was felt in the United States and also in Britain. And Arvid went to the United States, went to DC, and basically offered himself up as a source to the State Department, and they refused to believe it. They thought he was trying to double cross them in some way. His cousin, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who's a rather well-known figure in the resistance, he was involved in the 1944 Valkyrie plot to assassinate Hitler. And we all know about that because of Tom Cruise and the movie Valkyrie. So for those of you who have seen that film, or sometimes people think of it as the suitcase bomb plot, but Dietrich Bonhoeffer also, tried to warn the Brits, and the foreign minister just refused to believe him as well. And it wasn't until after the war that a number of figures, including the head of the CIA, said, yeah, we messed that one up. We should have listened. And so there is that astonishing moment when Arvid and his colleague, Harro Schulze-Boysen, had been accumulating evidence that Hitler was about to invade the Soviet Union. And both of them got jobs in the ministries in order to basically pose as Nazis and obtain top secret intelligence about Hitler's operational and military strategies, and then pass them on to Hitler's enemies. And Mildred participated in passing this information too, both to the Soviet Union and also to the United States. And there's that, and you alluded to it earlier, Maris, there was this report that was a summation of 6 months of intelligence that Arvid and Haro had obtained from the Ministry of Economics on Arvid's side and from the Luftwaffe on Haro Schulze-Boysen's side, and along with specific missions that were planned, and they were compiled in this report. And I show a picture of this in my book, and I also show on that the top page Stalin's handwriting. You know, when he scrawled this profanity across the top of this report, he refused to believe that Hitler was about to invade him. They had signed a pact, basically, that they wouldn't invade each other, and so he didn't think Hitler was about to double cross him. He thought that once again these Germans who purport to be in the resistance are just trying to swindle him and fool him. And I found this document in an archive in Moscow, and it was a tremendous discovery. So it appears in this chapter called Stalin's Obscenity, because anyway, what he scrawls across it is, you can read it for yourself, I'll keep it clean. But this is what he scrawled across the top of this report. And, you know, a few days later, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Tell me about putting this story together and being the one to perhaps to say, you know, look at this brave woman and look at all of her accomplishments. How does it feel?
To be related to her, you mean?
Or to
know the story?
To bring the story to the public.
Yeah, I think for me, it's very gratifying because it's a story that I felt I had been wanting to write for many years, and then I kept putting it aside. Mm. And I thought, well, I'm not quite ready yet. I think I'm going to write another novel. And so I kept doing that. And then I spent 6 years on my third work of fiction, and then actually set it aside in 2016 in the run-up to the presidential election. And I thought, I have to write this now. I felt this tremendous urgency to share her story. I wanted people to know this history. And I thought, you know, this is going to be important for people to understand the risks that people took in Nazi Germany to resist. It's a small group. And I should mention, you know, her group, she called it the Circle. That was her nickname for it. But it was a very diverse group. There were Jews in the group, Catholics, atheists. There were factory workers and professors and students. 40% were women. And very few people know about this group. They intersected with three other groups over the course of 8 years. And then by 1940, they had become the largest underground resistance group in Berlin. And so I felt that, and again, as I said, almost everyone lost their lives. The women were decapitated, the men were hanged or shot. And for many years, the history of this group was just suppressed. And in fact, the United States government suppressed Mildred's story. And I go into it, since we're running out of time, I won't go into it now, but I go into that in the book. And it's really the process of silencing her, of burying her memory. That's a theme that runs throughout the book. Yeah. And so I felt like it's immeasurably gratifying to give her a voice and to share her story with readers.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Before we go,
thank you.
Do you have some book recommendations for us?
Well, I would love to recommend, I'm so steeped in this history, and I've been reading voraciously about the 30s and the 40s and the Second World War and memoirs and works of narrative nonfiction and biographies and histories and even novels about this period. So I could sort of rattle off a bunch of names, but I think that what I'd actually like to focus on is Anne Carson's book, Knox, which really was, I keep rereading it, but this is my favorite. I cherish this book so much because it's like an object and you open it up, it has this case and you take it out of the case and it's this accordion sort of arrangement of pages. And I read it, you know, and again, I read it years ago, and it inspired me to approach this book in a different way. I wasn't quite sure how, but I thought, I saw that it could be done in this way that was really, really provocative. And also it refuses to be one thing or another. I mean, Knox is basically, you can think of it as this tremendously inventive biography about her brother who committed suicide. And so she conceived of this book as a kind of epitaph, and she incorporates bits of poetry and scraps of letters and quotations. And, you know, basically she addresses the fact that there are gaps in the story. Yeah. She doesn't know everything. And instead of hiding that and trying to write her way around it, she illustrates it. And I thought, now that's the right approach to this history as well, because there will always be gaps in the story. The Nazis burned the trial transcripts. She participated in a, Mildred underwent two treason trials, and the second one was when she was ordered to be decapitated. And so we don't have those transcripts, but we do have we have the sentencing documents, but not the transcripts. The Nazis destroyed other documentation, as we well know. And my own family participated in the destruction of documentation. My great grandmother, will come full circle, this, the mm-hmm. woman who measured my height with the ruler in Chevy Chase, Maryland, when I was 9, ordered the family to burn every letter and photograph of Mildred. And she did so for complex reasons. One is, I think that was her way of dealing with grief. And she basically told the family as much, that the sooner that we bury all this and destroy it, the sooner we can get on with our lives, she said. Okay, it's one way somebody has of dealing with grief.
Yeah.
You know, little did she know that her own mother had hidden a stash of letters in the attic. And so my grandmother discovered these after my great-grandmother passed away. And so you can't get rid of the memory. It's still there, but there are still gaps in the record. So going back to Anne Carson, I think that, you know, she shows us that when there are these gaps, when there's no historical record that tells us, you know, why did she was plagued with this question, why did my brother commit suicide? And I was plagued with the question about Mildred. What was she thinking, feeling? Why did she make the choices that she did? And she is a complicated, enigmatic woman. And Carson showed me that, you know, when there are these gaps and when there is no answer, that you can allow the gaps to show, you can allow the silences to resonate, just as in a good piece of poetry or music, and that there is meaning and beauty in those gaps and silences.
I love that. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you, Maris. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.